Autist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and thanks for joining the program today. We're going to start with a quote from the commentary of His Holiness the Dalai Lama to the text we've been following for some time now, Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's a continuation of the quote we ended last week's program on. His Holiness says this about spiritual practice. In the beginning, we should have a clear overall view of the path so that we know what we're aiming at in our practice and recognize the level we've reached. Then, as we practice regularly, we may experience profound changes in our minds. But these experiences only occur when we are concentrating in sessions of meditation. Later, after meditating for a long time, we find that these experiences occur spontaneously when we encounter particular circumstances without our needing to concentrate in meditation. He takes the example of meditating on bodhicitta, the mind that takes on the responsibility to attain enlightenment, to be of the greatest benefit to all living beings everywhere. He says that after we've meditated on bodhicitta for a while, we will find a change in our minds, but only when we are thinking of bodhicitta. This is not real bodhicitta. It's a fabricated experience. If we keep on meditating on bodhicitta, though, after a long time, when we come across any creature, a human, an animal, or a bird, the thought, when will I ever attain enlightenment for this being, will arise from the depths of our heart. This is the real thing. His Holiness calls it a natural experience, and says the person who experiences it is then a genuine practitioner of the Mahayana path. The Tibetan Gelug tradition stresses this gradual process of meditating on a topic until we achieve an experiential understanding. At first, the topic may be strange and the understanding quite forced, but as we become more familiar with it, it gets easier and easier to grasp. We continue to meditate on it again and again, and eventually the mind becomes so familiar that, as His Holiness says, we will note a real change in attitude and understanding, what some people call an aha moment. Further meditation will lead to the mind eventually becoming so familiar that we find we've undergone a fundamental transformation. And that is when, as His Holiness says, our transformed experiences occur spontaneously when certain circumstances arise. This is not the only way to transform the mind, and different traditions have different methods. But every method involves some form of discomfort and suffering. We cannot hope to transform the mind while sitting in a comfortable armchair, sipping on a nice cup of Twinings, and following our usual habitual urges and desires. But as we heard in the last program, Shantideva compares the suffering that we have to go through trying to attain enlightenment to the suffering we go through if we don't try, and shows that the first is much less than the second. He says, "The objects of desire will certainly perish, and then I shall fall into hellish states. But Buddhahood itself is attained with just 1/1,000,000th of the difficulty involved in continually exhausting myself for the sake of what is not very great. Hence, the desires experience greater misery than those following the awakening way of life. But for them, there is no awakening." And that is where we ended the program last week. And Shantideva pointed out that no matter what we desire and go after in this life, it will fail us. Because everything is impermanent, objects of our desire, whether human or not, will duly disintegrate and die, and we will remain unsatisfied. All that will be left will be the habitual desire that we have strengthened on our mind stream, and that will result in unpleasant experiences. The habitual tendency will not, however, be eliminated, but will lurk in our mind and influence us to repeat the same destructive actions again and again. And again and again, that will result in painful experiences. So it's never ending. In contrast, the difficulties we will experience to attain Buddhahood are significantly fewer and have a definite endpoint. Once we become an arhat, we will be entirely free from suffering, and never again will desirous objects trouble us in any way. Nor will the mind of desire be able to steer us like it has done since time immemorial. So Shantideva says that not only do those who give in to the desirous mind experience more suffering than those who work to attain nirvana, but they will never find any relief from their suffering. Those who attain nirvana finally get the big prize. They will never suffer again. And now, before we continue, let's set our motivation as we usually do. As we've been talking about bodhicitta, please set that as your motivation for participating here today. Failing that, make your own liberation the cause for today's efforts. Of course, as His Holiness mentions in his commentary at the beginning of the program, realistically, most of us will attain enlightenment many lives from now, and so our prayer should be to attain a human rebirth again and again, so that we can continue to build on this life's practice. So we could just motivate to gain a precious human rebirth, but that is surely the smallest motivation we should aspire to. Anything less than that would not even be a Buddhist motivation, as I've pointed out in previous programs. So let's set a motivation of bodhicitta if possible. Thank you. Now, continuing with the text, Shantideva hammers his point home. When, having contemplated the miseries of hell, it will be clear that there is nothing comparable to the harm caused to desirous beings by weapons, poison, fire, ravines, and foes. Having in this way developed disillusion with desire, I should generate joy for solitude. The fortunate ones stroll in peaceful forests, devoid of disputes and disturbing conceptions. They live in joyful houses of vast flat stones, cooled by the sandal-scented moonlight, fanned by the peaceful, silent forest breeze, thinking of what is of benefit for others. They dwell for as long as they wish in empty houses, at the feet of trees and in caves. Having abandoned the pain of clinging to and guarding possessions, they abide independent, free of care, living as they choose, desireless, having no ties with anyone. Even the powerful have difficulty finding a life as happy and content as this. Having in such ways as these thought about the excellences of solitude, I should completely pacify distorted conceptions and meditate on the awakening mind. Now, the chapter we are going through is on meditation, and in these verses, Shantideva has pointed out the disadvantages of the mind that is always wanting this and that, and now points out the advantages of retreating into solitude and practicing to transform the mind. One of his favorite spurs, as those of you who have been with us before will realize, is contemplation of the results of negative karma, particularly birth in the hell realms. And up to now, he's been quite heavy in his condemnation, basically of following the lay life with its many troubles and its potential for igniting the fires of desire, which lead to rebirth in states of suffering. Thus, he says that once we've seen the damage, as from weapons, poison, fire, ravines, and foes, that following our negative desires and urges will do, we will become disillusioned with desire and want to retreat into the forest. And he paints a very idyllic picture of the life of forest dwellers. In his forest, there are no wild, ferocious animals, no hordes of mosquitoes, flies, or other troublesome insects, no venomous snakes, and no bandits, which is a little odd, as all such dangers can be found even in the forests of India. In Thailand, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, and other such countries, The monks go out and live under the trees and on stones, often to confront and overcome their fears, rather than to look for an idyllic existence. However, I guess Shantideva is pointing out that even the possibility of tigers, bears, snakes, and biting insects is preferable to the life of a person ruled by desire. Certainly in the line, "I should completely pacify distorted conceptions," he hints at overcoming our habitual fears and neuroses about nature and all that is in it. The teachings on the graduated path to enlightenment say that when we go into the forest or some secluded place to meditate, we need 6 conditions for our practice to be successful. These are a suitable place, little desire, contentment, lack of multiple activities, pure ethics, and the abandonment of disturbing conceptions. Now, when we talk about a suitable place, the teaching lists 5 qualities to look for. The first is that it should be a place we can easily get necessities, like food, water, clothing, and so on. When I did a 1-month retreat in Temuata on the Coromandel before I became a monk, I was in a hut a good 30 to 45 minutes walk into the bush, and that wasn't along a road, but following a rough and sometimes precipitous path through streams and over ridges. The hut had a water tank that was usually quite full, although it had an uncovered hole at the top that had looked like a toilet to a possum or two, so all the water had to be boiled. But Tim, the guardian of Temuata at that time, very kindly brought me a little fresh veggies and fruit every week. Otherwise, I ate tinned and dried food I had taken in with me. And it being summer, I didn't need much clothing. The second quality of the place is that it should be in a safe location. And this is easy in New Zealand, as we don't have any ferocious animals or venomous creatures as there are in places like India. One Tibetan Lama who visited New Zealand said it was the best country in the world to practice the Dharma, one of the reasons being that we are so free of harmful interferences. We're even unlikely to be harmed by robbers, whereas in a country like South Africa, for instance, being out in the bush by yourself would be quite a different proposition. Then the place should be clean, with fresh air, good views, and a moderate climate. Again, Temuata was exactly like that. The hut was on a cliff overlooking a valley that led to the sea, and the view was stunning. The air was always fresh, even though the wind was sometimes strong enough to make the hut sway. And then, if there are people about, they should be good friends and practitioners like oneself who can support the meditation practice. As I said, Tim was a good friend while I was in Temuata. One day, I decided to try and stop the possums from crawling all over the outside sink, which was my wash basin and dishwasher. I found some old bits of wood under the hut, and while I was fashioning a possum block, an old rusty nail sticking out from a piece of wood stabbed into my hand. Fearing tetanus or something worse, I clambered through the bush back to the retreat center and spoke with Tim there. He very kindly dropped everything and took me to the doctor in the nearby town of Tairua, where I duly got a tetanus shot and some disinfectant. Tim then took me back to the retreat center and made me lunch before I went back to the hut. Tim was a Vipassana practitioner and hugely understanding of retreatants, so he's the sort of person you need for support, both physical and moral. Then finally, the place should be quiet and peaceful, both by day and night. Now, my hut at Temuata was great for meditating during the day. Only once or twice did people briefly pass by on the path behind the hut, and being in the middle of the bush, I was undisturbed by any traffic or building noises. Unfortunately, however, at night, the possums thought it was a nightclub come race course, so they would either dance above my head or see who could get from one end of the hut to the other first, and that was over the roof. Not at all that conducive to beautiful rest. However, I was partly to blame, because following the example of my teacher at the time, who had fed the possums when he'd done a retreat at Matemuata, I gave them breakfast every morning. They obviously thought I was a good friend or an easy touch, and me casa es su casa. My advice is, if you're going to be virtuous and feed the animals while on retreat, Do it far away from your living space. So those are the five qualities you should look for in a place to retreat to. Somewhere where it's easy to get necessities, a safe location, a place that is healthy, where there are good friends, and where it's quiet and peaceful. Then the second of the six requisites is that we should have little desire. And we've already covered this point extensively with Shantideva, but the point is that on retreat we must have few wants and be satisfied with what we have, be it just basic necessities. In his text, The Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism, Geshe Lodin jokes, "You do not need a wardrobe filled with designer clothes to calm the mind. A variety of delicious foods prepared as a three-course meal by the best Italian chef in the country should not be considered essential for a successful retreat. Wanting more and more will be a great distraction." And then the third requisite is to cultivate contentment. As I said, basic necessities are just fine, and the mind must be kept happy with whatever is available. Geshe Lodin writes, "Remaining contented requires that you do not grasp at having the best condition, but be satisfied with having enough. However, you should be sure to have sufficient. There are some who believe that for a retreat it is necessary to fast and to have no concern for being protected from the heat and cold by having suitable clothing and shelter. Now, this is the other extreme, and it will not help you, because if your health suffers, you will not have enough energy to concentrate properly, and you will not last the distance. And then we have to give up being busy with many activities. We should have very few activities, and certainly not have work obligations, meetings, letters or emails to write, and so on. In fact, I doubt that it's a very good idea to take internet-connecting devices on retreat, for the social networking and internet browsing temptations may be just a little too strong. However, if you are deep in the bush, it's a good idea to take a mobile phone, just so people can check on you from time to time or give you a lifeline to the outside world in an emergency. When my teacher did a year-long retreat at Temuata, he took a mobile phone so that his attendants could let him know the days that they would be visiting with fresh food and so on. But I had no attendance, so I relied on Tim and had no phone. In any case, it is best to cancel all activities that have no bearing on your retreat and keep extraneous activities to the barest minimum. And we have to keep pure ethics for a successful retreat. Geshe Lodin recommends that if we break our precepts through lack of mindfulness, we should immediately do proper purification to restore them, and says that pure ethics is the foundation of concentration. So, for instance, even if the possums do dance on the roof at night, don't wish or do them any harm. And then lastly, as Shantideva says, we have to give up disturbing conceptions. Geshe Lodin says we have to remember that everything that we find attractive in cyclic existence is impermanent, and it won't be long before we will be parted from it all and have to give it all up. Therefore, it's much better that we stay unattached to it all. In any case, Shantideva has already made a good case for the misery to which disturbing conceptions lead us, so we don't have to go further into that. Now Shantideva, taking bodhicitta as his object, describes how we are to meditate. First of all, I should make an effort to meditate upon the equality of between myself and others. I should protect all beings as I do myself, because we are all equal in wanting pleasure and not wanting pain. In what way are others equal to us? Asks His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Just like us, they naturally want to be happy and to avoid suffering. Although on analysis we are unable to find an I that truly exists, we are still convinced that it does exist, and we therefore consider that we have a right to be happy and a right to escape unhappiness. But this is also the case for all other sentient beings, so there's no particular reason why we should be any more important than them. Why should we accomplish only our own happiness and not be responsible for the other's happiness? Why should we make an effort to avoid suffering for ourselves and not be responsible for doing the same for others? Pema Chodron, in her commentary, says much the same thing and takes it a bit further. Shanti Devi's instructions, she says, are an antidote for our usual narrow, confused sense of me and mine. We begin by contemplating the sameness of ourselves and others, she writes. Philosophically, we might discuss the insubstantiality and false security of a separate self. But when it comes to actually dissolving the illusory barrier between this self and others, we work on a practical level and keep it real. The myth of separateness is very convincing. Even though it causes us enormous pain, it's definitely not easy to shake. This myth is addressed very directly by the practices and teaching on the equality of self and other. They expose the agendas and strategies of self-importance and change the way we see one another. Simply put, if you've ever lived on the streets, you can never look at a panhandler the same way again. You've been there, you know what it's like to be down and out and to ask for money. This experience automatically brings down the barrier. Likewise, if you've ever been hospitalized with a serious illness, you know how people can pass in and out of your room without ever seeing you or treating you as a person. In the movie Wit, the dying heroine is seen vomiting into a basin while a staff person asks, "How are you feeling today?" Having experienced this kind of depersonalization yourself, it's difficult to relate superficially to someone else who is very ill. Imagining ourselves in another person's situation shakes up our indifference. We begin to realize that in joy and in sorrow we are all equals. Our suffering and happiness are the same. Misery is misery and joy is joy. Therefore, whether we feel sorrow or relief, we understand how others feel. Understanding the equality of our joys and sorrows widens our perspective. Somehow, staying caught in the web of self-centered thinking is not so easy as before. And now, continuing with the theme, Shanti Deva uses the body as an example. Although there are many different parts and aspects, such as the hands, as a body that is to be protected, they are one. Likewise, all the different sentient beings in their pleasure and their pain have a wish to be happy that is the same as mine. His Holiness the Dalai Lama explains, when we try to protect our bodies, we also protect the parts of the body, such as our hands and feet. Similarly, since the happiness and suffering of others are all part of the same happiness and suffering that is ours, we must protect others from suffering just as much as we protect ourselves and strive for others' happiness just as we do for our own. And then Pema Chodron also says, the analogy of the body represents one whole with many unique parts. The ear is not the toe. The tooth is not the eye. Yet these individual parts also aren't separate. If our toe hurts, our whole body feels it. If our leg is cut, our hand reaches out to help. We don't experience our leg as other and say, "Oh, how interesting, look at the blood pouring out." Shanti Deva uses the analogy of the wholeness of the body in several contexts. Here, it refers to the interdependence of human beings. All of us, unique and not separate, and just like me, all of us wanting to feel good and not bad. In her commentary, Pema Chodron uses the Padmakara translation, which for the lines, "Likewise, all the different sentient beings in their pleasure and pain have a wish to be happy that is the same as mine," has, "Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are like me, all one in wanting happiness." Pema Chodron chooses to see different beings and as human beings, but I think Shanti Deva's intention is greater than that, and a sentient being is the right reading here. For it is obvious that just as I do not want my leg chopped off, a dog would prefer not to have its leg amputated. Never mind that we are human and animal. Our suffering is the same, as is our longing to be free of suffering. I saw a story in the Huffington Post recently about an American boy and a dog that nicely illustrates the point. The boy's name is Johnny Hickey, and he's autistic, which made it difficult for him to interact with others and left him isolated. The dog is named Zena, and she was an abused and abandoned puppy who'd almost been starved to death. The Huffington Post reports, according to the magazine Today, a shelter in Georgia's DeKalb County found the terrier last September. Just 4 months old at the time, she'd been severely neglected and most likely locked in a cage without food or water before being dumped on the streets. I've been doing rescue probably for about 12 years, and I'd never seen a dog that young in that sort of condition, Chrissy Kaczynski, an animal services worker in DeKalb County, told Today. Despite her condition, Zena, who's been nicknamed the warrior puppy, fought hard to survive. Her recovery even inspired a Facebook page, which in turn helped Linda Hickey find the dog that would change her son's life. "I fell in love with the dog on the internet," she told Today. The 44-year-old mother of two lives with her family and two older dogs in Johns Creek, Georgia. She brought 8-year-old Johnny to meet Zena at a fundraiser in November. "We were literally there for 4 minutes, and Zena ran right up to Johnny and my husband," Hickey told Today. Although Johnny is usually shy and introverted, upon meeting Zena, he came out of his shell. "From that very first day, that dog was sitting in his lap in the car seat, giving him all these kisses," Hickey told Today. "And that's where she's been ever since. He's non-stop chatter now. He's the happiest child that I've ever seen him be in 8 years." The boy and the dog have made a few YouTube videos together. A recent one recognized April as both Autism Awareness Month as well as Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Month. "My name is Johnny, and this is my puppy, Zena. Well, my Zena was hurt really bad by some not-so-nice people, and I have autism. So I think we make a pretty perfect team to spread the word to be nice to animals and nice to kids like me," Johnny says in the video. Now, if you go onto the Huffington Post website, you'll see photos of the appalling state that Zena was in when she was found, and what a healthy and loving dog she is now with Johnny and his family. All the creatures on this planet, even that tiny flea that jumps onto your leg, want the same thing, to be happy and not to suffer. But as long as we cling to only our own happiness and try to free only ourselves from suffering, we will never be able to realize the interdependence of all living creatures, from the smallest to the greatest. Once again, the Metta Sutra springs to my mind, the part where Buddha says, "Wishing and in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Well, whatever living being there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease." To really understand how close we all are, we have to realize that the suffering of the fish on the hook is our suffering, and the joy of the swallow flitting through the sky is also our joy. It is the realization, no matter how we see ourselves as different, we are not separate in this, that we all equally want happiness and equally do not want suffering. When we can really penetrate that, it becomes very difficult to harm others and not to bring them joy. And on that note, we must wrap up the program for today. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to the enlightenment of all beings, and that, of course, includes you. Thank you, and see you again next week. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.
You can